assholes, sit down and listen up, because it's another oneliner.com podcast and you're just going to have to deal with that. I, as always, am Craig. With me, Scott Morris.
Hello.
And Drew Tavendale.
Hello.
And you're not really assholes, you're beautiful, beautiful people. I just felt like calling you assholes, because I can. All right?
Does it make you a big man, does it?
Makes me big.
Makes you proud, doesn't it?
Clever. Not proud. I'll never be proud. I can't be proud since that incident.
Thought we weren't mentioning that again.
Exactly. It's hard to be proud when you're arrested with your manhood caught somewhere it shouldn't be.
The backseat of a Volvo.
You bastard, you had to bring it up.
That's what she said.
You had to bring it up. Edit most of this out. So, it's another oneliner.com podcast, and it's about high time we started talking about films, so that's the turning we're about to take. So, Spider-Man reboot, probably not necessary. Drew, is it necessary?
It depends on whether you're Sony Pictures or not. So before I go any further, it may be worth mentioning why it's being rebooted. For those as yet unaware, unsurprisingly, it comes down to money. Sony basically had to keep making Spider-Man films, otherwise the rights revert to Marvel. That's all it is. They keep the rights as long as they keep making the films.
And what better way to catalyse art than financial necessity?
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. So that being the case, and after having parted ways with Sam Raimi, the director of the last two films, rather than continue his take on Spidey, they've decided to begin again with 500 Days of Summer director Mark Webb and a screenplay from James Vanderbilt, Alvin Sargent and Steve Clovis, who between them have worked on Zodiac, Spider-Man 2 and 3 and all 8 Harry Potter films. Now, rather than just beginning in the Spidey universe in medias res though, The Amazing Spider-Man is yet another origin story. And one which anyone who has seen Sam Raimi's 2002 Spider-Man will find extremely familiar. So familiar, in fact, that there are very few significant differences, one of which is unnecessary, one arguably inconsequential, and the other two coming down to casting. So let's deal with the unnecessary difference first, as it allows us to look at the plot. When Peter Parker's very young, his father Richard, a brilliant scientist, discovers that an intruder has broken into his home, searching for his groundbreaking genetic research. He and Peter's mother, fearing for their safety, go on their run, leaving Peter with Richard's brother Ben and his wife May, and are never seen or heard from again, apparently dying in a somewhat mysterious plane crash a little later. After stumbling upon some of his father's research work years later, 17-year-old Peter comes into contact with Dr. Kurt Connors, his father's former colleague. Also comes into contact with Oscorp, and then later some genetically altered spiders, by way of a rather bizarre spider sifting stroke tipping device. And all that follows really does bear a great amount of resemblance to Tobey Maguire's first outing as El Hombre Araña. Now, the arguably inconsequential change I mentioned is that Spidey has returned to the classic web shooters, i.e. mechanical shooters of his own devising. Sam Raimi's take has seen his be biological and a result of his spider bite induced bodily changes, something which always made a lot more sense to me. But here Peter makes them himself, which I suppose does have the added benefit of allowing us to see Peter's prodigious intelligence and engineering skill. The two casting changes I mentioned are very much swings and roundabouts. There is no J. Jonah Jameson here, the filmmakers wisely realising that no one could replace the ever-brilliant J.K. Simmons, whose take on the Daily Globe editor is possibly one of the most perfect pieces of casting in film ever, and certainly is in comic book movies. So instead, the role of prime citizen persecutor of a hero falls to Dennis Leary's police captain. But this lack of J.K. Simmons is made up for in large part by the engaging Emma Stone as Peter Parker's love interest Gwen Stacy. Stone's appealing, funny, witty, warm, and, well, basically she's everything that the perpetually miserable Kirsten Dunst isn't. So with all of that said, is it any good? Well, yes, it is indeed. Andrew Garfield is a likeable Spidey. There's a good sprinkling of humour throughout. There's well-handed action sequences and everything you'd want from a big-budget superhero tentpole, except for basically anything you hadn't seen before, particularly in Sam Raimi's first Spider-Man. I'd still have no qualms recommending it as a solidly entertaining way to spend a couple of hours away from all this bloody rain, however. Just don't expect to be blown away by originality.
Scott, what would you tip on top of that particular review pudding?
A topping of nothingness. I think if you can perform a Jedi mind trick of separating this from the previous film, then it's actually at least as good, or swings and roundabouts. It's slightly better in some ways and slightly worse in other respects. But if the original series of Spider-Man films hadn't existed, then this would be very welcome indeed. It's a very enjoyable film. There's lots of pretty decent performances. It's actually a really enjoyable action hero film. If you're young enough to either not have seen the original Spider-Man, well, the Sam Raimi version of Spider-Man films from, you know, a decade or so ago, then it's a really good introduction to the character. I think Andrew Garfield's probably somewhat better as Spider-Man than Tobey Maguire was. He seems more comfortable with the kind of smart aleck aspects of Spider-Man's character. Perhaps in many ways the characterization of Spider-Man's a little bit better, in as much as he's not a complete wuss before he becomes, before he gets his powers. He does actually have a reasonable kind of moral standing before then. He tries to stand up for people weaker than himself. Admittedly, he's not very effective because he's not very strong, but that kind of sorts itself out over the course of the piece. Characterization is, yeah, let's say, probably a little bit better. A lot of the acting is reasonable enough for this kind of thing. It suffers somewhat from having a particularly undefined bad guy to go against. Reese Evans is Kurt Connors slash the Lizard. Seems to have no real motivation other than I am a lizard. And I must have missed the 2 second or something moment where he decides to go from, rather than I am a lizard myself, to I am going to make everyone else lizards also. That's not particularly well handled, but that can happen quite a lot when you're more focused on the hero rather than what the hero's fighting. But I think this is a particularly enjoyable way to spend an evening. It's only if you're getting into these kind of meta games of whether it's worth seeing or whether it's substantially different from the Spider-Man from a few years back. But if you just want to watch an enjoyable film, then go ahead, give it a bash. It's really quite good.
Bash that. Killer Joe sounds interesting, and it's a film. Scott, tell us about the interesting film Killer Joe.
Thanks, generic Dave.
No problem, man.
Killer Joe was mildly interesting to me, perhaps because it was deemed worthy enough to, I can't remember if it was open or close the Edinburgh Film Festival. Clearly some people think there's something interesting about it, even if it does star Matthew McConaughey. Directed by William Friedkin, which again is another name that will at least pique my interest, if not make me actually like a film. It seemed like it had an interesting premise. A young lad, Chris Smith, decides he needs to get some money to try and get himself out of debt to some nasty loan sharks to pay off some of his gambling debts. And obviously the best way to do this is to arrange to have his mother killed and collect a life insurance policy on her. As part of this, he decides to rope his family along with it, particularly his flighty younger sister Dottie and his gruff, not exactly sharpest knife in the drawer, Father Ansel, played by Thomas Hayden Church. The plot, such as it is, consists of him attempting to get the eponymous Killer Joe Cooper, played by Matthew McConaughey, a policeman by day and assassin by night, who's contracted to try and kill his mother. However, they don't have the cash to put up the money up front, so he agrees to take the job only on condition that he be given Chris's sister Dottie as prepayment, so to speak, as collateral. Killer Joe's main issue is that it is somewhere between a thriller and a comedy, and it seems to be attempting to take, to try and do both seriously. It tries to become a very blackly comic thriller. The main issue is that it's not particularly thrilling, and it's also not particularly funny, which means that it's kind of something of a big empty black hole. There's not really an awful lot to it when you sit down and think about it. The plot itself isn't really interesting enough to carry it along, other than it having some unpleasant characters trying to get themselves out of nasty situations. They've dug themselves through their own weakness. There's no particular empathy built for any characters. It appears to be basing the entire film around the what one would hope would have to be a powerhouse performance, but it's Matthew McConaughey. So while it's one of the least terrible Matthew McConaughey performances I've seen in a good long while, it's still a Matthew McConaughey performance. Okay, so there's
with faint praise, isn't it?
There's very much an upper limit on what you're capable of getting out of the man. And while it's not a bad performance, to be fair, there isn't really an awful lot in the film that's particularly interesting, and he's not charismatic enough to carry it by himself. The supporting cast is, you know, somewhat better. But the only character that's particularly likable in some way is the somewhat lethargic performance that Thomas Hayden Church puts in as Chris's father, who, again, is not a particularly likable character, but he has enough charisma at least to kind of pull off some sort of charm with it.
Mm-hmm.
As for the rest of it, it's just not quite interesting enough. There's hints there where it looks like it's about to turn into something particularly interesting, and it never quite does. The climactic scene at the end seems to be dropped in as a total deus ex machina. It doesn't appear to have any particular relevance to what's happened before or after. It just seems to be a way to kind of neatly wrap everything up, and it's not a particularly satisfying ending. It's the only scene that has any kind of emotional impact, but it's basically written in as a 5 minute, oh, here we go, let's finish this up kind of idea, and it's not particularly, it doesn't feel like it's flown from the rest of the film. I'm not quite sure what I expected going into it. It's the trailer looked somewhat interesting, and I guess the film was somewhat interesting, so it kind of delivers in that respect, but it's not a particularly great film. There's really nothing in here that can latch on to and give any kind of recommendation for. There's nothing out of the ordinary about it. It's not thrilling enough, and it's not funny enough, so a bit of a problem for a comic thriller.
That's a shame. I was quite intrigued by it, actually, see what William Friedkin is up to, because his last couple of pictures have been interesting, so I shall probably seek this out on DVD, but yes, not one for the cinema then.
No.
Boo. And indeed hiss. Ooh, Drew, what's all this about the angel share?
Okay, violent young thug Robbie is due to become a father, and having been thrown a lifeline by a judge who imposes a community service rather than a custodial sentence for his assault conviction, he wants to take the opportunity to turn his life around and make a life for his family. Not that this is going to be easy. His partner's gangster father despises him, and when he isn't assaulting Robbie, he's trying to bribe him to leave. And there's also the small matter of the inherited feud between himself and another Ned called Clancy. And much as he may want to... Ned, is from the Wild West.
Clancy,
yes. So much as he wants to, Robbie can't promise his partner Leone that he could walk away from confrontation with Clancy, his nemesis, as he believes he would just get stabbed in the back as he did so. But he's unexpectedly introduced to the pleasures of whiskey by a kindly social worker and malt connoisseur called Harry, and Robbie discovers he has a real nose for the water of life. And this in turn leads to a potential way out of his cycle of poverty and violence and a new life for his family. So far, so much so social drama. But the angel share sees Robbie take a morally dubious path to improve his life. He aims to escape his life of crime by committing a crime. Enlisting the help of three fellow young offenders, Robbie plans to steal a few bottles of one of the world's rarest and most desirable whiskies. And here the film changes tone. From bleak social drama, though certainly there's some humour early on, the film becomes a caper. The usual strengths of director Ken Loach and regular collaborator Paul Laverty are on show here. Brutally realistic portrayals of lives filled with violence and hampered by poverty. Heart-rending moments of grief and consequence. Here an encounter between Robbie and the victim and family of one of his violent assaults. Leavened throughout with black humour. There's also a good deal of broader humour here, and The Angel's Share is considerably lighter than many of Loach's movies. Though perhaps too light, the second half of the film seems somewhat mismatched with the downbeat cycle of violence first. However, the two halves of the film may not gel together entirely, but the transition from social realism to caper isn't as awkward or as jarring as it could be or that you might think it would be, and the compelling performances and the deep humour make this a very enjoyable and rewarding watch.
Scott, have you got anything to add?
Apparently in this podcast, Chris decided to make people want to hate him.
I agree with most of what Drew has been saying. I more or less agree with all of that. It's a strange beast it works far better than it has any right to, if you...
Yeah, absolutely.
The more I would attempt to talk about it, I could probably talk myself out of liking it, because it is such a strange mix where the first half is this, the kind of bleak socialism that you'd probably expect from Loach, harking more back to the Sweet 16 film of a few years back, with the same kind of tricks, you know, inexperienced young actors who are naturalistic performances, perhaps in some cases a little bit too naturalistic. There are some flaws with it. Leone, Robbie's girlfriend, and doesn't really have any role other than to nag him. There's no real warmth between them for an awful lot of the film, and it's kind of strange seeing this kind of social situation where there doesn't really seem to be any particularly good explanation of how these two characters ever got together and ever wound up where they are. For the first half, where it's focusing so much on the character of Robbie and his kind of surroundings and his circumstances, it would feel awfully flawed if it kind of ended there. And for it to just sort of stop and then become a crime caper, this little heist drama at the end of it, in a very lightly toned. Each half of those works, but they both work almost independently of each other, and there's almost no crossover between the two, and it's a very strange kind of tone that it takes, in a obviously hopelessly dubious moral message. Yeah, it's a strange beast. I don't really know quite why it works so well. It's a sort of jarring changeover that should really sink the film, but it doesn't. And I suppose we'll have to give Loach some credit for that. It manages to kind of coast by in enough charm and enough humour to have both halves work quite well.
I think it helps too, Scott, that Similarly, the very first scene is really, really funny. It just sets your mood and your acceptance up really early, sort of gets past your any barriers you might have. So you're already on a sort of thinking favourably towards it because that first scene at the railway station is so funny.
Yeah.
it sort of lowers your defences there.
Yeah.
You're right, it shouldn't work, but it does, and it's really entertaining.
Yeah, I enjoyed this a lot. A laugh riot, as it were. So, yep, give it a bash, as long as you can understand the accents.
Clancy! Oh.
Scott, The Detachment is a film with stuff what happens in it and that. What is the stuff what happens in it and that in this film, The Detachment and that?
Yeah.
I'm on holiday, bitches.
The bulk of The Detachment is essentially about character pieces and flaws in the school system, which is not the sort of thing that will have people rushing to the cinemaplexes, I'd imagine, but it is worth it in this case. It centres mainly around Adrian Brody's character of Henry, a idealistic young substitute teacher who kind of drifts from classroom to classroom and giving it the old inspirational student kind of thing that you've seen in a great many films. It was like very Dangerous Minds-esque. He's surrounded by failing schools, perhaps the best way to put it, and teachers, many of whom have given up all hope, some of whom have some real mental issues, some who are just, you know, tired of the whole lot of things, and some who are managing to kind of keep their heads and humour above water, particularly James Caan's character. It's a very bleak film, as you might expect from Tony Kaye. And Tony Kaye is one of these directors who have never quite been able to tie up the films that he makes with his actual physical appearance, which is like some sort of homeless Santa.
He's sort of like a startled Kubrick, really, every time I see him.
He seems like the kind of person that should be making the kind of films that, I don't know, Tim Burton makes, whereas instead he makes very grim pieces like American History X. And this has the same kind of level of almost hopeless despair running through a lot of it. It is essentially a character piece. The main bits of it is focusing on, you know, Adrian Brody's character and also his relationship with a young prostitute that he helps to kind of, you know, get off the streets and kind of back into society, and their relationship, which is more of a kind of father-daughter thing than any kind of romance there. It is one of these films that I don't like using sort of kind of somewhat meaningless terms like powerful to describe a film. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, but it's the sort of thing that this is custom made to be described as. It has a lot of emotional impact. It's based on a school system that I still struggle to comprehend. I've now seen this happening so many times in so many films and other works that the American school system appears to be a little more than a juvenile detention hall rather than a place of learning, which is something that's so completely alien to, well, all of us. Obviously, we went to the same school, and it was in no way anything like as bad as this, or even the kind of lighter jocks versus nerd kind of clan warfare that you get in most certain more school-based comedies.
The portrayal of American schools in American TV and film seems to come down to one or two things, isn't it, Scott? It's this, which is basically hell with juveniles, or it's like everybody's in these cliques and there's 18-year-old jocks who beat up all the weaker nerd kids and stuff, and it doesn't seem even vaguely familiar to me, or I suspect anybody in Britain. It doesn't ring true at all, but you see it so often, you've got to think perhaps that is what schools are like in the United States, and if they are, good grief. They're screwed.
Yeah, that seems to be the overriding message of this film, is if you do have a good teacher and someone who does actually care, and you try and put a bit of effort in, the system will still try and drag you down and screw you out of everything that you want to do anyway, and you're not going to have your happy ending. It is a bleak, miserable film, but bleak and miserable in a very enjoyable way. but it is a really good film to watch. There's lots of really great performances in there. There's not a weak link alongside them, even the characters who, even actresses who I normally don't like particularly much, like Lucy Liu, I don't think often can not be a particularly great actress, but she does a good performance in here. Lots of really nice touches, even from the supporting cast. There is an awful lot of really admirable stuff in here. It's one of these films where you can't immediately recommend that everyone rush out and see, because it is such a downer. It's a very bleak film indeed, but it's a really strong film. There's lots of good social commentary in there, and I think that's part of what makes it such a good and such an interesting film to watch. Not one for just a good times past the afternoon, unless you particularly want to be depressed for the rest of the day. But no. It is a really good, a really powerful film, and it's one of the better films I've seen this year. Yep, terrific acting performances, very strong script, hopefully not realistic to anyone who has school-age kids, particularly in America, but very powerful stuff, and I liked it an awful lot.
Drew? Unsurprisingly, I don't have a lot to add to what Scott said. And well, I have seen this film be is criticised for being this deep social commentary but not providing any answers, although I rather think that's the point. There aren't any answers. Nobody seems to know what the answers are. You have all these idealistic teachers who have great ideas about really wanting to help. People want to help these young children, and then they just become empty shells after years and years of being unable to help, whether through the system or just the kids are unhelpable or various other reasons. They become shells. They become detached from the world and from their original ideals. And that's part of why it's so great. It's just, it's a recognition of the difficulties these people have. Powerful is the word. It's a very rewarding watch, but in no way entertaining. It's one of those type of films, but it's just sit down, quiet evening, when you're prepared to have something challenge you a bit and give it a watch. It's very rewarding.
It's like broccoli. It's good for you, but you won't like it.
It's not really that like broccoli. It doesn't give you gas or taste disgusting. Just one more thing, as you said, it's got very strong performances all around, even from people that have not been a particularly fan of Lucy Liu's either. Particularly strong centre performance from Adrian Brody, who, when he's given something to really get his teeth into, is fantastic. And actually generally one of those characters who rises above the material. He is at least vaguely passable in Predators, even though the material around him is awful. It's worth mentioning in particular Sammy Gale, who some people might know from Sky Atlantic's Blue Bloods. She plays Nikki in that, as the young prostitute that Henry's trying to help. She does a very appealing performance, very engaging.
Interesting stuff. Well, there you go. Hopefully that was some informed opinion. Well, undoubtedly it was informed opinion, because that's what we do. We will be back in another couple of weeks. This new schedule's going all right, isn't it?
Yeah, well, let's not get ahead of ourselves, but we're doing really, really well.
Yeah, it goes to show, if you write it down, it does happen. But there you go, that's the sort of cutting-edge thinking that we're known for. Writing stuff down.
We made a plan, and we stuck to the plan, and that seemed to work quite well. We're groundbreakers.
Craig, Scott and Drew, writing stuff down since 1979.
Although, to be fair, probably scribbling for the first couple of years.
Probably. Crayons, and well, I still use crayons, I'll be honest.
I like the texture!
You're not supposed to eat them.
Yeah.
Self-taught!
We will be back in a couple of weeks. Oh yes, we will. I feel quite confident in saying that, with reviews of, amongst other things, The Dark Knight Rises. But until then, I have been Craig. Scott was Scott.
See ya.
And Drew was the inimitable Drew.
Farewell.
Light one if you got him.
Hold on.
Amanda Holden?
Are we not going to pick an order we're going in?
Blade Runner?
In your own words, tell me the thoughts that come to your head when you think only good things about your mother. My mother. Let me tell you about my mother. Blow!
Was that Al Pacino taking a Voight Kampf test or something?
Yeah. Tell me, Mr. Pacino, only the good things that come into your head when you think about your mother. She got a great ass!